Thank you for tuning in to Cop with Comic. I'm Brian Cop, and we're with comic Seth Lawrence. Seth Lawrence, how the hell are you?
Okay, I'm doing well. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much for coming on. And we follow you everywhere. You are Seth T. Lawrence on Twitter. And you're only Seth Lawrence on Instagram. You're the famous Seth Lawrence. That there's only one. But you also have SethLawrenceComedy.com.
I do.
Nice. And what we're going to talk about today, well, I mean, real quick, before we talk about the law and everything that's cool about it and everything that people do not understand about it when they get all inflamed about politics, before we do all that, we're going to talk about your upcoming shows. I think you have your own show, which is Clean Up Comedy, right?
Yeah, I do. Clean Up Comedy is a monthly. The next one's going to be on the 19th of January. So this may be out by then. It might not. And then we're still kind of negotiating the date in February, but it's probably going to be the 16th of February. So we're doing it once a month on Wednesdays, typically the third Wednesday of every month.
And why are you still negotiating the day? Is it kind of a venue thing or is it a COVID thing?
Yeah, venue and COVID, and then trying to find the perfect lineup of comics who can make it out. So
I mean, I love it. You said perfect lineup of comics, and then the parentheses it was who can make it out.
Yep.
during the freakishly cold, 60 degrees there and COVID. Like,
oh man,
you learned all that in law school. Yeah, no. In contracts, there's a force majeure clause that probably would encompass COVID, right?
Yeah, I would think so. Because if you can't go out, you can't go out. You know.
You can't sue these fucking people. The one thing they don't teach in law school is, like, when it comes to, like, yeah, you could be in the right. Somebody might have broke a contract you had with them to show up at your show, some big headliner, but then you realize that the damages were minimal, and the court would laugh you out of court. The judge would laugh you out of court if you tried to sue for those damages, right?
Yeah, well, and the other problem people don't quite understand is that you can sue and win and still not collect because the client or the person you've sued is indigent, and that...
That's hilarious. I did not even think of that. That is fucking funny. Not only do you know the law, but you're also funny. You just fucking pulled that out of your ass. Yeah, a lot of comedians are indigent. We can't collect on this judgment. They are judgment proof.
Right. And indigent, for those who don't know, is just fancy for poor.
Poor as fuck. Try to get a nickel out of them in court, and they'll be like, with debtors. Like, it's like I went to law school, you went to law school. It's like I have all this debt and shit. And it's like all these little collectors are like, we're going to garnish your wages. It's like, good luck. Get behind the IRS. The state taxing authority. Of course, all the federally guaranteed student loan people will be like, nah, dude, he owes it to the U.S. Department of Education. So fuck those people. And that's kind of something you learn in law school. It's like, you know, if it's unsecured debt, who gives a fuck? You know, if your house is not securing your mortgage, then who gives a fuck about not paying somebody back? It's only if you get money from loan sharks or something, do you have to worry about that shit?
Yeah, at least your leg's breaking, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, for most people, it's a credit score. That's the issue.
Yeah, they want a house someday. I don't want this law school debt because I want a house. It's like, so we're the same. We just have different debt loads, right?
yeah, exactly. And for rich people, it's called leverage. So
yeah, like Trump and all that shit. But yeah, I think there is a close link between all that stuff. And but real quick, I mean, as far as the people you're booking on your shows, when they were all able to come out because there was no virus, kind of what was the common thread of who you were booking?
I honestly book who I think is funny.
Okay,
that's it. That's all I care about.
Who do you think is funny? Just people who are just
talking. Just white guys. Think that you think. Just straight white men. They are the funniest to me. in LA, it's a great comedy scene. I've got to meet a lot of really great comics, some more well-known than others. And it's just people that I've made friends with who I know are funny and who want to try to work clean. Because that's the other caveat for my show, is that it's late night friendly. The whole impetus for the show was, let's help comics do clean comedy in a space where they feel supported to do clean comedy. Because there are lots of clubs in LA, but your clean set doesn't always hit nicely if you're following like an Eleanor Kerrigan who's going to tear up the room but is filthy, And then you come out and everyone's like, who invited the Mickey Mouse Club to come do comedy tonight? What is this?
I didn't think about that. I didn't think of how difficult it would be for a clean comic to follow a dirty one.
I mean, you know, funny is funny. So I think if you're clean and funny, then that's awesome. And I found it a really useful test to get out in these clubs and do material that I would do normal. You know what I mean? But for comics who don't work clean all of the time, they fall back into what I think is a crutch of using bad language or using, foul descriptions to elicit laughter. But if you have a clean show, then they are, in my mind, elevated or challenged to be more clever, find a different way to tell the joke, which may be funnier and it might not be. So anyhow, it was just a way to help comics develop a clean set so that they could book a late night spot or, you know, do
because that's the only thing club. That's the only thing standing in their way. That's the only thing standing in their way. Like once they get those good 5 minutes, they're going to be booked on Fallon immediately, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's
dude, the other night there was Kimberly Denaro was one of our guests, and she just made it onto the Tonight Show, and she sang a song about a Roomba. And I'm just because I had seen it, and I was like, she's taking a picture at the Tonight Show or something like that. And I was like, all right, she went. And people were like congratulating her. I was like, why? She just went to the fucking show. Then like it doesn't surprise me because she's hilarious, but it's like, yeah, the next day she finally, you know, she and the Tonight Show shared the picture of her like, you know, singing stuff on a piano about a Roomba. And I was like, that is so fucking cool. Like just kind of slow roll it like that. It's like, you guys might want to watch the Tonight Show tonight. It's like, why? Because we're going to see you in the fucking audience. Like, no, I'm on the fucking show. That's amazing. And, but yeah, it just goes to show. It's like, it's not really because she's been, you know, in addition to being on my podcast, like, she's just been doing it, just fucking churning out quality content for years. Yeah. And then she gets on with that. Who would have thunk that Jimmy Fallon would book a guest to sing about a Roomba? It's just, I mean, so it kind of goes to show, like, it's not just having the clean 5 minutes. It's also fucking the grind that she has displayed. And kind of what have you noticed about the people who are grinding on your show? Like, do they have anything in common other than wanting to develop that clean 5 minutes?
And we try to give them like 7, you know, because that's what I've been told is the typical audition for a late night spot. The
other thing I want to say, they're going to cut it down, right? They're going to cut it down.
They can always edit it out. But the other thing I'll say is that it's kind of sad how little a late night spot means anymore. I mean, it's a big deal, but it's also like there are people who have been on late night that you've never heard of, you know, and they'll do like 10 late night spots and then you start to hear of them. It's just crazy. The world is so different for comics now than it was in like the 80s when that was it. You know, you got on Johnny Carson and you were made, you know?
This is kind of a moment where there was 3 channels and millions of people were watching each one and that was the only thing they were watching.
Right, exactly. But to answer your question, I mean, the thing that I see common for people who tend to do really well on the clean shows is just they're good writers and there are lots of different ways to write. Some people write on stage and just have to get up a ton. And some people write, you know, in a coffee shop or privacy of their home and then work it out on stage later. But they are all hustlers. I mean, they're all out doing stuff all the time, you know?
But what does it mean in LA to hustle?
You're going from show to show. You're trying to get on as many shows as possible, do as many mics as possible, make as many friends as possible.
But in LA, that's like 5 mics because of the traffic, right? People out here are doing 28 mics a night, right?
Yeah, that is a huge difference for New York and LA. And I don't know what the scene's like in New York if you get pockets of comics like Newsies. You know, you have like the Brooklyn comics, the Queens comics.
I think there can be cliques, but I think that you know, they like the LA comics know it's smart to cross pollinate, and so like that's what I love because you know in the beginning like my first guest was Steven Rogers who I hadn't heard of, and it turns out he had been on the Colbert Show too, but like you find out
that's my point.
I know. Yeah, I was speaking to the earlier point, and it's just like if the comedy scene in New York or anywhere were a monolith, nobody would ever go on my show. They'd all just be waiting to get on Rogan, right? Right? They'd be like,
Right.
who the fuck is this guy? And some people were like that because they just go on each other's pods and they're too big, I suppose. But like
Yeah.
other people, these hustlers, they cross-pollinate like fucking crazy. And it's only later that they discover that I retweet their funny stuff, which is so funny because some of these people, 50 likes, no retweets. And you're like, are you kidding me? Like none of
Right.
these fellow comedians, you know, thought it was appropriate to retweet your funny shit. It's like I saw somebody with like, you know, 2 retweets and 100 likes. It's like, and I step in there and I'm just like, I will retweet these motherfuckers because I got no shame. Whereas I think they're thinking if they retweet it, they're almost admitting to their own following that this guy's funnier than I am. So like
Oh,
maybe I should just
interesting.
like it and not retweet. I'm like, fuck that. And so I think, you
Right.
know, the benefit of cross-pollinating is that, I mean, you just get on all, you know, you get on all the shows, you get to know all the people, like you said. And are they also supplementing the whole, you know, in LA, are they supplementing the getting on stage and making friends with everybody? Are they supplementing that with like, you know, doing their own shorts and things like that or TikTok?
Yeah, there is a lot of that for sure. There's a lot of that. And I don't know if it's like this in New York, but there is almost a level of, man, because there's so many great comics in LA that it's like at any, I don't know, there's kind of this illusion that at any moment you're going to be seen by, I don't know, Theo Von, right? And then taken on the road with Theo and that's it. You're done, right? Like you've made it. Like I did a show with a person who's open for Christina Pazitsky, and you know, she was very personable, super likable. But I've also done shows with people who open for, you know, like Brennan Schaub. And it's like, oh, you'd never want to talk to me again? I met you when you did an open mic when you moved to LA and we were buddies, and now, you know, too cool. Too cool for me, I guess.
Because you opened for Brendan Schaub. That's hilarious. Like, if you are Brendan Schaub, sure. I understand we can't be friends because you have famous friends, but like, who the fuck are you?
You know, if it were Brendan Schaub, I don't think I'd be friends with him because it's Brendan Schaub, you know?
Oh, he's just he's a great guy. You just know he's wonderful.
Believe in it. Everybody's a child of God.
And so, I mean, you've had famous people on and like in looking at, you know, the big names who've been on your show and the people who I haven't heard of, kind of what do you notice that some of the bigger names are kind of flexing, they're just kind of experimenting because they're using your show for that? Or are, you know, just that, do they know that Theo Von's in your audience and they have to kill him? Because I mean, like, that's the danger, right? You get somebody on your show and they're fucking around. Whereas if you get somebody naturally hilarious and they're doing their best 5 minutes, like the audience is going to love them.
Yeah. Right. Of course. No, I think, every comic uses their stage time however they want, you know, but I'm the what? Reason I book for like people that I know and friends that I know are funny is that they do take it seriously. They do take comedy seriously. And so inevitably there will be a mess up on my show where somebody will let a curse word slip, that would not be allowed on late night television. And, you know, we just all, it's fine. We roll with it. We're all adults. We can, you know, the audience is cool. There was a guy headlining and he asked to do my show. This is Jason Cheney. He is such a lovely, I love Jason. He is so nice. He's great. He's been touring all over the country. He asked to do my show. So I was flattered. I was like, yeah, absolutely. Come do it. And so he gets on the show and he gets up there and his first, like, I don't know, 3 minutes is him just dropping the F-bomb like many times as he can.
What do you do?
And, well, the whole audience, I was shocked because I was like, it was very clear he was trying to like hype up the audience for his performance, you know?
Okay.
So he gets up there and he's like, F yeah, I'm so glad to be here in this epic place.
It wasn't even a material. It was in the pre-show hype.
It was in him like trying to hype people up for, and then he turns and I have this sign up, you know, that says clean up comedy. So I thought, oh, he's going to realize. And then he's like, yeah, F yeah, clean up comedy. We're effing here, guys. And I then shout out, I was like, Jason, it's a clean show, dude. You asked to do the show. It's clean.
Did you shout out? Like, cause that was a good time.
I did.
To shout
yeah,
out,
I
right?
did.
Oh, it's cool. It's clean.
I did,
just be like, it's clean. That's why it's up. It's a clean show. No curse words, right? That's funny.
Well, I just said, you know, it's late night friendly. You've definitely hit the limit on the F. And you know what? As soon as he realized, and it was kind of like uneasy, he'd been doing some material talking about, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt and how, and how, you know, his pontification on that phrase. And so, so I yell out at him and I'm like, dude, it's a clean show. Cause I don't know, you can see comics who are really talented. And if they're in a situation where they're doing material they know is good and gets laughs, but it's not for some reason, you see that like self-doubt, you know what I mean?
Okay.
And so he was exhibiting that. And so I was like, this is why no one's laughing. It's because you're punctuating everything with the F word, you know? I was like, and everyone's uncomfortable because it's a clean show. So
you interviewed so, and then he straightened up?
Straightened out. Oh, yeah, yeah. He was like, oh, my bad. You're right. That's right, of course. And then this woman in the audience goes, it's okay, Jason. We'll give you the benefit of the doubt.
They were paying attention.
Hitting his punchline. You know what I mean? So
then huge, they were back with them.
Huge reset for the room. They loved it. And he was like, that was funny. And I'm hurt that that got the biggest laugh. So
good.
And then, he pivoted. He pivoted and was like clean. He was doing the same material, but was clean for the rest of his, you know, his 15, 16 minute set. And that was like one of the most professional things I've ever seen happen.
Yes.
You know,
that is so cool. And would you, could you have done that? Like, you know, do you have the chops where you can kind of adjust your set mid set, depending on what's going on in the room?
You know, I don't struggle with that with language because I work clean all the time. But as far as, even just last night, I was starting in on this material and like, you know, I was raised in Utah. So I say I'm from Utah. And this guy goes, well, what part? And I'm like, have you been to Utah? And I got totally sidetracked with him because I was like, this was supposed to be just a throwaway line just to set up the next thing. And this guy, you know, it's a small crowd. There were like 10 people in the audience. So I was like, why not? Why not engage? And then after that kind of fun, you know, it was fine. But then I was trying to like pivot back into my jokes. And I was like, I don't even remember. I wanted to talk about why I'm jealous of babies. But now we're into Utah. And so, you know, I pivoted into more of my stay-at-home dad material, which was fine. But I realized in that moment, like, I have struggled. When I first started doing it, stand-up, I would focus in on people who didn't seem like they were having a good time.
Okay.
And I would just get lost in trying to get them
into
the show.
Why? Not the like theory that if I can get him in, you know, if that person is having a problem with my material, chances are other people are as well. So let me try to bring that person back to the fold. And that way everybody comes to the fold. And did you realize that that was incorrect or no?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's at the sacrifice of everybody else who's having a good time, you know. So
how long were you into it? How long were you into it before you discovered that? How many years?
I think when I started doing shows, I was probably about a year in, and then about a year and a half in, I realized like I can't cater to some idiot in the front row who's not having fun, you know?
Yeah, because nobody sees that person. It's just like I think Matt Ruby used to have Sandpaper Suit blog where he says you can't respond to a heckler if nobody heard him. Because if you start going hard at a heckler, people are like, why is the comic yelling at the guy? And so you have to make sure that people heard it and even repeat, oh, you know, oh, this guy said this, blah, blah, blah. And then that way they're all on your side. But I guess, my question too is, you know, when I was in law school, I was a big moot court guy, you know, and what you do with your moot court is like they're peppering you with questions. And you find if you drop a certain throwaway phrase and that leads to questions, you need to kind of excise that from your act. Your argument. So it becomes a process of sanding down the rough edges that catch on people's shirt. You know, like you're walking past a prickly bush, your shirt's going to catch on it. But once you trim that bush, nobody, you know, so it's if you discover something in your act needs to be sanded down because it's going to, you know, I don't know, invoke the hecklers. It's going to trigger the hecklers or trigger the, you know, weird audience response or whatever. Like, do you excise it from your act or do you look for opportunities in a way to say it more neutrally?
I think there's a mix because like I said, that kind of throwaway setup of being from Utah has never elicited a response ever. And for whatever reason, this guy who I honestly, I noticed him. He was on his phone, and I wanted to be like, hey, man, thanks for coming to the show. There are only 10 of us. You're in part of the light on stage because it's a small room and you're on your phone. But, you know, I didn't engage with him at all. And then from his phone, he's like, what part of Utah? So part of it's like,
I'll look
well,
it
at
up.
Least you're listening.
I will look it up.
You know? Yeah. At least you're listening. That part's good. I think, man, and I've not really been heckled in the sense of like a mean-spirited heckle.
Yeah.
You know?
It has the same effect, right? If it still throws you or the audience, you're fucked.
Right. And it depends, you know, like I think I handled it okay. The audience still had a really good time. But as far as for me, what I wanted to work on, and that's the part that I don't think a lot of audience members really understand, is that comics go up to on stage with a purpose. I will say good ones. Good ones will go up on stage with a purpose, stuff that they're trying to work through or work out or see if it works if they say it a certain way.
Yeah.
And that's the damage that any heckle does, mean-spirited or nice, is that it throws you off of your, or it can throw you off of your performance. So like I wanted to work on this, you know, jealous of babies material. And I got sidetracked because I ended up talking about Utah for way longer than I thought I ever would talk about Utah.
So you almost need to chalk it up to never happens again, because you could have said to yourself, all right, I could have responded to it quicker. I could have said, you're on your phone, look it up, and then moved on. But it's at the top of your act, and you come off as unlikable. So you have to just, you can't overlearn that lesson. That's another thing in moot court. Like I had you're practicing with all these law school professors and they're peppering you with all these questions and stuff designed to throw you off. And I had a clerk for Scalia. So Anton Scalia, was Anton or Antonin or Scalia?
Antonin.
Yeah, so he's got like only the brightest, you know, lawyer clerks and shit like this. And this guy like hit me with this question and I was never the same after that. I changed my whole whole argument based on the fact that he took a weakness and just be like, yeah, but it's just judge's discretion, right? I'm like, yeah, you're right. It is the judge.
Yeah.
And so I overlearned my lesson so much that like the altered presentation didn't do as well in competition. So I ultimately reverted back, but it can throw you so long. And I guess that, you know, that's a part of being a true professional, is you cannot overlearn a lesson. Like, you know, if somebody heckles you up top, hit them hard, hit them quick and move the fuck on, because then you come off as unlikable. So you almost have to say, I have to write this off. It's never going to happen again. It's never happened before.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think it's also an analysis of the opportunity. That might sound weird, but it's like, you know, you can do big rooms or a bar show, and a bar show is sort of like, let's just have fun. And if you get heckled at a bar show and you want to engage, well, maybe you can mine something fun that you can recreate later in a different setting.
Yeah.
But you're also not risking.
What do you mean by that? You can kind of experiment there in the moment and then bring it up as a funny thing in a future bit.
Yeah, or you just find some angle that is different than you ever thought about it, you know?
It's like stage brain. It's forcing you to think, to kind of write on the spot.
Yeah, right.
That's
exactly.
Cool. I mean, it's like everything is an opportunity. That's cool. Like, you know, any single challenge, like if somebody comes at you, it's an opportunity to either cement your connection with them or at least with the audience at large, right?
Right. Yeah. Or figure out, you know, how what's a good way to deal with a heckler. You know, you can go up with that kind of game plan too.
Invite hecklers by making sure that all these kind of weirdly provocative worded statements are in your act. And I guess, I mean, my question is, do you think that there's similarity between arguments in law, because you were a lawyer. I mean, you graduated law school. I think you were a law clerk and lawyer at some point. I mean, do you think in arguing, there's anything, you know, any similarity between that and a comedy act? Because essentially you're trying to argue, I am funny.
Right.
Convince that, but in your facts and your legal arguments, your legal support and your factual support for your argument in law is kind of the same as your jokes in comedy, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you also have to be credible. You have to be credible too. And so it's like, and I guess some of that is if you have a bunch of jokes about being a stay-at-home dad or being jealous of babies, and then you start talking about, you know, being promiscuous on the dating scene, people will be like, you're not credible. I'm not believing a word you say.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think there's the biggest, I think, commonality between them is this point of view. You know, you have to have a very strong point of view for your argument to make it coherent. You also need a strong point of view to make your jokes land. You know, the like people say, anything can be funny. Yes, But, you know, if you're going to start dabbling in potentially racist or racial jokes, you better have a really strong point of view so you don't come across as a racist. You come across as ignorant, you know, or you come across as, and it, I guess if you want to come across as racist and that is funny to you, then so be it. But
if you're a dad, like if you're coming off as the dad, like the Danny Tanner, the Bob, well, not Bob Saget, but Danny Tanner, Bob Saget as Danny Tanner on Full House. Like if you have kind of a dad, you know, dad friendly, dad consistent act, you know, if you ever want to dabble in something provocative, it would always almost have to be from the point of view of oblivious, you know, like Bill Burr says, I've been living in a, you know, if you're a parent, you've been living in a bubble for 20 years and you get out and you discover that everybody's moved on, but you, so you almost have to come off as, oh shit. I did, you know, what I just said was totally ignorant. And I had no idea. And my kids corrected me or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you can make yourself the bad guy in that way, you know, to make it more palatable. Right. And all of that for the audience. And my point of view is religious dad. So it would be, and if, you know, in the sense of getting racial, I think the most racial joke I make anyways, it doesn't matter. But the point is that you have to have a strong point of view and you have to be consistent with that point of view, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest common. I mean, there's also, like you mentioned, you have to have kind of your facts. There's a similar structure in the sense that you have facts in law and then you have the argument that you're trying to make. And in joke writing, you have the premise and then you have the punchline. And there's a very similar analytical thought process that goes into all of that.
And so what's that? I mean, the similarity has to be if your jokes, it's like, okay, if your facts, like for example, if I have a legal argument, any fact that did not support that legal argument, I would kind of excise from the brief because it might distract or detract or whatever. So in your way, if you find a joke lands, but it does not really relate to the premise, it's like you should just move it to something else or change it to something else or put it into a chunk.
Yeah. Or if, you know, you have a punchline, there are certain pieces you need to have in place for that punchline to hit. And those are your facts. You know, that's the premise that you need to set up. You need to have everything properly set so that when you hit the punchline, everything falls the way you want it to.
And I guess some of that is, you know, if your persona is dad, just like why a sitcom works. It's like you don't have to explain in every joke that Danny Tanner is a dad. It's like we know he's a dad, so we don't have to establish. And so that's why persona is cool, too, because then you're like, you know, Seth Lawrence is a religious dad. And so we know he doesn't have to kind of set that up. That is set. And so everything else, we just only need a couple facts before we start landing. And that's why the act is so punchy. But we follow him everywhere. Seth T. Lawrence on Twitter. He's only Seth Lawrence on Instagram. But he also has Seth Lawrence Comedy, and your next show I think is coming up real soon. So the next couple cleanup comedy shows, which are super clean, are January 19th.
Yep.
And the one after that, in case this comes out too late, is February. Yeah. You're still negotiating it, but it's usually the second Wednesday of every month.
Third Wednesday, so it'll be February 16th.
And where's the Nightcap?
Nightcap is in Burbank. It's on 2200 West Burbank Boulevard.
Burbank, and give me the words I want to hear. Is there free parking or available parking?
There is. It's a residential kind of area. Free parking. Burbank is a great spot to park. Tons of parking.
That's what I learned on this episode. Burbank, it's a great place to park. Seth Lawrence, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Brian, so much.